If the people managing your money were leaving trillions of dollars on the table, wouldn't you have some questions? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Oakland, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, November 5th. Good to have you with us. First up today, the latest on the U.S. trade deficit. That is, of course, the measure of whether we imported more than we exported. Well, from September to October, that deficit shrunk by about 4.5%. That sounds great. But unfortunately, it's because imports and exports both dropped. It's just that imports fell more. In other words, there was less economic activity like manufacturing and retail for the U.S. economy overall. And that's not so great. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman takes a closer look.
U.S. agricultural exports fell hard in September as retaliatory tariffs, especially from Asian countries, hit hard. Take apples. 95% of U.S. exports come from Washington State, says Jim Baer at the U.S. Apple Association.
The Chinese New Year is everything. So, for example, if I was coming to visit you, I would bring you this perfect apple from the United States as a gesture of good health and prosperity for the coming year.
Baer says in China and India, they love U.S.-grown Red Delicious, and for the last few years, sales soared until the U.S. slapped tariffs on Indian and Chinese imports, and they retaliated with 60 to 70% tariffs on U.S. apples.
We are going to have our ninth largest crop in history, but at the same time, exports are down about one-third, close to $200 million, which, frankly, is a lot for the apple growers.
Another link in the supply chain is agricultural equipment and other big rigs, tractors, earth movers, and the like, made by classic American manufacturers like Caterpillar and John Deere. Their export sales to foreign customers are falling, says Elizabeth Vermillion at CFRA Research.
Now you have tariffs and trade and slowing global macroeconomic headwinds.
Plus, U.S. farmers are so uncertain about the trade future, will China buy their soybeans, will India buy their apples, that they're holding back on buying new farm equipment for next year. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The devastating California wildfire known as the Camp Fire ignited a year ago Friday. It killed at least 85 people and leveled the town of Paradise. The fire has been blamed on faulty electrical equipment from the state's biggest utility, Pacific Gas and Electric. Liabilities from that fire helped push PG&E into bankruptcy last January. And now there's a battle over how PG&E should emerge from Chapter 11 and who should run it. 22 California mayors have an idea. Turn it into a publicly owned cooperative utility. Here's Marketplace's Justin Ho on what that might look like.
PG&E answers to its shareholders, who want a nice return on their investment. Publicly owned cooperatives work in a very different way, says Jeffrey Connor of the National Rural Electric Cooperative Association.
They're established in a way that the consumers own the co-op and elect a board to guide the direction of the electric utility rather than having shareholders.
Californians are tired of having their lights shut off, and the group of mayors says PG&E isn't doing enough to prevent wildfires.
More than $7 billion have been paid out in dividends to shareholders, while the company is underinvested in basic maintenance and capital upgrades that are needed.
That's Sam Liccardo, the mayor of San Jose. He says a public takeover would save money, no more dividends for one, and a public co-op would be exempt from federal taxes. Liccardo says those savings will help the company, say, clear brush from around its power lines.
Those kinds of investments take a lot of dollars.
There are about 900 publicly owned utilities in the U.S., but nothing at the scale of PG&E, which serves more than 16 million people. Economics professor Severin Bornstein at UC Berkeley says if those customers were to own the utility, they'd be assuming a lot of risk in the event of more wildfires or other disasters.
So that means taxpayers who are behind this municipal utility are on the hook.
PG&E declined an interview, but in a statement, it said changing the structure of the company would not improve safety and said its facilities are not for sale. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, economic activity declines, markets shrug. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. When Facebook announced plans to introduce a new digital currency called Libra, it rattled financial regulators all over the world. In fact, today, a draft document from the EU says the European Central Bank should consider issuing its own public digital currency. And with tech companies getting into banking, financial services, and payments, regulators have a lot more to contend with. Yelena McWilliams is the chairman of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, also known as the FDIC. It is in charge of banking insurance, yes, but also monetary oversight and consumer protections. I spoke to her at a recent financial technology conference. Yelena, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
How do you think over time the actual fundamental role of the bank might change? Like, you see a lot of companies saying, you know, we're payments processors. Do you think banks will still be processing payments in the future? Will they make all their money on consumer loans? Like, what, you know, how do you see, as there's so much competition, things, the roles starting to stratify?
I think it's very interesting, the place in time we're at right now. And one of the things that fascinates me is, what are the banks of the future going to be? You know, is what is the ATM of the future going to look like? What is the teller of the future going to look like? I joke it's going to be a kind of a, here's your deposit and here's your cappuccino. Would you like whole milk or soy milk?
I want that machine.
Well, we have to think about the FDIC sticker on that machine.
Right, true.
But, you know, the question for us on a regulatory side is, are we going to be standing in the way of that innovation, or are we going to be open-minded enough while making sure that the banks are safe and sound and there's adequate protection?
Can we talk about Libra for a second?
We can't talk about a specific currency because of our regulatory framework, but I'm happy to talk about generally crypto assets and cryptocurrencies.
I mean, where do you see this going? How long is it before a central bank or a government issues a cryptocurrency?
So I know there are talks underway as to what the role of the regulatory bodies in this space is, right? As a regulator, you want to make sure that innovation is able to foster, but at the same time, there are certain developments, such as the crypto assets, that have the possibility to undermine the whole central banking system of a country, right? One of the things that needs to be decided, you know, is it an asset or is it a security? Is it a currency? If it's truly a currency, then we need to start thinking about the implications of that, including what does that mean for the deposit insurance. So I'm open-minded while at the same time making sure that the regulatory agencies are working together so that we don't have a fragmented approach to how we regulate and look at this development.
Are there, do you think, other innovations that can answer some of the needs that, you know, Libra points out, which is a global seamless payment system, the ability to serve the unbanked in an easy and digital way?
So every time we see a disruptor, I always ask why. Why were they able to step in and do this? What was lacking in the marketplace that, you know, somebody planted a seed and there was fertile ground and the seed grew into this product? And so as I looked at the cryptocurrencies and crypto assets, the issue of real payments, real-time payments comes into place. One of the things that I want to make sure that we don't do is either bless something we're not sure about and we don't understand its implications for the consumers in the marketplace. But also we don't want to discourage innovation. And it's a fine, I feel like I'm on a seesaw every day and I'm trying to figure out how to create that balance where we do enough to encourage innovation, but we don't do something that would cause the system to irreparably go into disarray.
I mean, it must be difficult. You see these companies kind of plowing ahead. You know, you see people saying the U.S. is so far behind on blockchain. And actually, I would imagine that almost every regulatory body feels this way, that you don't want to get left behind, but you don't want to do it wrong. And the stakes when it comes to global monetary policy are way higher, right?
Yes.
I mean, how stressful is this for you?
Well, it's stressful, all right. Doing laundry is stressful as well in my household. Here's the bottom line.
So laundry is as stressful as Libra. I can write that down?
No. Don't use Libra. Don't use Libra. Just say crypto assets.
Oh, right. Of course.
Here's how I look at this. To the extent that these currencies and crypto assets and blockchain are developing to help society be better, we need to take the big picture into equation here, right? Central banks of the world have a very easy job of saying no immediately and stopping all of this in their tracks. The fact that that has not happened should tell you that it's a positive development, I think, because the regulators are at least taking the time to understand the implications while analyzing the impact on the system. And so it's stressful because you don't want to make a mistake. And so we need to change at the regulatory agencies, because if you really think about it, we're dealing with a 21st century technology with a workforce from generally the 20th century, based in some cases of some regulatory agencies on the laws and organic statutes that were given to us by Congress in the 19th century.
Eleanor McWilliams is chairman of the FDIC. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you so much.
There is more to my conversation with McWilliams from that conference. We talked about digital-only banks and competition. You can hear the whole thing on the Marketplace Tech podcast. Percent of venture capital investment goes to men, most of whom are white. And did we mention 90% of venture capitalists are men too? But by only investing in people who look like them, VCs are leaving a lot of money on the table, as much as $4 trillion, to be exact. That's according to a new report from Morgan Stanley. Carla Harris is vice chairman of global wealth management there. Carla, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me, Molly.
So I want to move up the money chain. When you put out a report like this, from Morgan Stanley, are you speaking not just to venture capitalists, but also to their investors, the limited partners who arguably are the ones who are holding the purse strings?
Yeah, we hope so, Molly. And that is part of what we're trying to do, is to say not only are you VCs missing it, but perhaps if you're missing it, you may be leaving some money on the table for your limited partners.
And I wonder, do you think that's where ultimately the change has to come from? Like, if LPs all suddenly introduced, you know, diversity riders, if every pension fund that was going to put some money into venture capital said, hey, my pensioners want you to do the best you possibly can, and that means investing broadly, is that what it's going to take?
Well, I'll tell you, I do think that would be powerful. There's no question that limited partners have power in this equation to also move the needle with the distribution of capital to women and multicultural entrepreneurs. No question. And you absolutely started to see some of that in the private equity industry, where LPs certainly did make a difference. So I think the same could apply here. That's very reasonable.
So what do you think it is? What is keeping venture capital from flowing? I mean, you know, the data is pretty clear on the homogeneity of this industry and all of those things. But when you really talk to these guys, what do you think is keeping venture capital from flowing to a broader set of founders?
I tell you, Molly, I think up until now, there's been a dearth of data that suggested that, in fact, there might be a differential with respect to returns, and that they were, in fact, missing something of value. I think in the last few years, there's been a lot of data that has been released that talks about the value of companies that have more women internally. So now I think there's far more data out there that is supportive of the argument that, in fact, there is something to miss. So I think that is, in fact, going to start to move the needle. But I think when things have been bumping along, you know, in fine form, and there was nothing to counter that argument, there was not necessarily a motivation or an instigation to change it.
Right. Yeah. And you don't necessarily. So a lack of data really only allows bias to continue, right?
I would say that's fair. It makes it easy for it to exist. Let's put it like that. Because it's hard to counter the argument.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you're proving a negative, I guess. The survey says that women earn 78 cents per dollar invested. Men only earn 31 cents. That should be enough evidence, right? We should suddenly, I'm sure that in the next year, we will see a flood of new investment in women and multicultural founders, right? We have to.
Well, I won't necessarily say it would be a flood, but I'll tell you, we would certainly be very happy to see that happen. If this one report made that kind of difference in the industry, we'll take that all day long, Molly.
Carla Harris is Vice Chairman of Global Wealth at Morgan Stanley. Thanks so much for the time.
Well, thank you so much, Molly. I appreciate it.
Coming up,
we've been told by billions of dollars of advertising money that our car is our identity.
Trying to undo the work of those billions. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average advanced 30 points, 0.1% to close at 27,492. The NASDAQ picked up just a point, basically flat, finished at 84.34. And the S&P 500 dipped 3 points, 0.1% to end at 30.74. Uber lost 9.8%. It reported earnings after the bell yesterday that beat analyst expectations, but the company reported over $1 billion in net losses for the quarter, a billion. The FCC formally approved the proposed merger of mobile carriers T-Mobile and Sprint in a 3-2 vote. The tie-up faces a hurdle in the form of a lawsuit by state attorney generals who want to block the deal. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.85%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Farming and ranching are tough jobs, and lately, so much tougher. Historic flooding this fall has taken a huge toll for farmers in Montana, where wheat is their biggest agricultural commodity. The trade war has seriously limited export options of wheat into China. And so with that said, here is today's installment of our regular series, My Economy.
My name is Michelle Erickson Jones. I am a farmer from Broadview, Montana. We raise wheat, barley, corn, sunflower, safflower, as well as forages, and a small cow-calf operation. There's definitely, you know, a lot of things that I love about being a farmer, but certainly being able to, you know, raise crops, raise food, work on the same land that your family's been on for multiple generations is something that is rewarding. Throughout the country, we've had excessive rain across the Midwest and Montana. There's been a lot of problems getting harvest completed. Combining that with our low prices as well as our challenges in the export market, it has made for a pretty difficult time for agriculture as a whole. The trade war has affected us certainly on our input side. You know, the cost of steel has risen with the steel and aluminum tariffs. There's also been other inputs that have risen with some of the other tariffs. We've also been impacted by the tariffs into China. China was a rising market for wheat, and especially for hard red spring wheat and soft white wheat out of Montana and the Pacific Northwest. When the trade war started in March of 2018, they stopped buying wheat, and they actually did not return to that market until just last week. They finally bought some soft white wheat, but that is the first purchase of wheat that they've made in over a year and a half. And that's been a substantial loss for us in the wheat industry. Overall, they were roughly a $450 million market a year. For Montana specifically, they were about a $65 million market a year, and they were one that we had targeted for expansion, not to lose our market share. We have excess wheat in the world. There's considerable wheat stocks in the world, and when we combine that with stagnating demand, then that's a considerable issue for us, and it has had an impact on our prices, which has an impact on our ability to be profitable, our ability to expand and make purchases and, you know, contribute to the rural economies. A you know, there's a lot of uncertainty in what our future in farming looks like. You know, we've made it through rough periods before. Our farm has obviously made it through the 30s. We made it through the 80s. You know, I suspect that agriculture will find a way to make it through it. But if it may look different, or parts of the countryside may look different than they did before this.
Michelle Erickson Jones. She's a wheat and grain farmer in Broadview, Montana. We need you and your stories to make this series work, so take a second and let us know how your economy's doing at marketplace.org. Cars and trucks are the biggest single source of greenhouse gas emissions in this country. One obvious solution to that is fewer cars on the road. Now, carpooling has long been the holy grail for how to solve that problem, but it's also really hard to accomplish. And after 10 years trying to help drivers avoid traffic, the navigation app Waze is trying to get its users to carpool together. Noam Bardeen is the CEO of Waze. Noam, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having us.
So I want to talk to you first about carpooling. Most people know Waze as a mapping company. You're about a year into this carpooling experience. And for those who don't know about it, how does it work?
So carpooling is basically an attempt to actually do something about traffic. So what carpooling tries to do is match you up with people that live close to you, work close to you, and leave more or less at the same time that you leave. And it creates these kind of small communities of people who live next to each other, work next to each other, and leave their car at home one day, the other person drives, et cetera, and allows them to leave their car and take cars off the road.
How do you connect? You're not hiring drivers, right?
Correct.
You're connecting people who are already driving with people who are interested in getting a ride?
Correct. So this is not a business. We limit the amount of reimbursement that you get to 58 cents a mile, which is the reimbursement for wear and tear on your car and fuel. And so you can't make money here. This is not Uber. This is not Lyft. This is not a taxi. But what you can do is help yourself, help your neighbor, and help the environment. But also individually for you, you're driving anyway. The carpool lane or the HOV lane can save you up to 30 minutes in California or 14 minutes on the East Coast on your everyday commute. And these are the kind of things that you can access once you have more people in your car.
So now, right now, you said you're not making money off of this, but you would presumably have to make it profitable in the future, right? How would that work?
So today, the rider actually pays a small fee, and that goes to the driver, right, to cover the costs. Right now, we're not taking any piece in that. Even more, sometimes we're actually subsidizing. Sometimes we're paying more to the driver than we are to the rider to create the density and get people to try it for the first time. Long term, we will take a piece of that transaction, right? Some kind of a fee off that money that's going in and out of our system.
Is the key going to be, though, in the future that it would have to be cheaper than Uber, say?
So that's always the case. We price ourselves much closer to public transit than to taxis. It's a way for masses of people to cost-effectively move between the suburbs and the cities. So it's obviously priced much, much cheaper than anything you would have in the sort of taxi world.
What is the hurdle in convincing people to do this? I live in California where we have something called casual carpool, which is
right.
Based on, you know, predicated on this exact concept. I think they have something similar in DC. So I have done this thing where I get in the car with strangers, but I can tell you my whole family freaked out about it. Like, how do you convince people that this is a safe and good idea?
That's exactly the challenge. I mean, the government's been trying to convince people to carpool since the Second World War, right? And it makes complete economic sense. But it's a hassle. It's a hassle, and a lot of people won't do it. More than that, we've been told by billions of dollars of advertising money that our car is our identity, right? That this is who we are. And we've been told by our parents not to get into a car with strangers. So what we try to do is limit the friction, make it as easy as possible to you. We give you all the information on the people. You can see who they are. You can decide, I only want to ride with someone from my gender. I only want to ride with someone from my company. Right? We give you all the tools to make the decision, and you're in control. At the same time, these are people that live next to you and work next to you. They probably have a lot more in common with you than you think.
You know, I wonder too, one of the sort of standing criticisms of Waze, because the focus is really on finding a better route and more, you know, a quicker route, that it's funneled traffic onto side streets, or there's the Waze left where you're in LA and you suddenly have to make a left turn where there's no stoplight. It is removing more cars from the road also a way to sort of counter that problem, which is that there used to be streets that nobody knew about that all of a sudden everybody knows about thanks to Waze.
So, you know, we're kind of been branded as the problem here. But the problem is not really us. The problem is the fact there aren't enough roads. And we can see the data itself, and there are multiple apps that provide routing now. Everyone's going on surface streets. What you hear a lot is people complaining about driving through their neighborhood, but they're happy to drive through someone else's neighborhood, right? As society, we need to take advantage of all the infrastructure that we have, and these roads are there. Carpooling is obviously the next step about removing the cars. And long term, if we don't do that, no amount of surface streets are going to help, because we just have too many cars and not enough roads.
Noam Bardeen is CEO of Waze. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
This final note on the way out is just a shameless diversion into a new category of thing I'm calling stunt foods. The latest comes from Pringles. Parent company Kellogg is now selling a Friendsgiving turducken kit, which includes Pringles chips in turkey, duck, and chicken flavors meant to be stacked, and chips flavored like cranberry stuffing and pumpkin pie on the side. I'm just going to tell you now, none of your friends are coming over for that. All right, we got to go. I got a turducken Pringles party to get to. The Dow Jones advanced 30 points today. The NASDAQ was basically flat. The S&P 500 dipped 3 points. That is 0.1%. Our digital and on-demand team includes Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Sitara Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. And I am Molly Wood. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.